I know it seems like I say this every couple of months, but we are not done with the financial crisis yet, everybody, not by a long shot. Also, the Pope on climate change, and we start a new series on this country's fragile infrastructure. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday, the 15th of June today. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. We are going to begin today smack in the middle of the Moral Victories Department, Financial Crisis Edition. Back in 2008, if you remember your somewhat recent history, the Federal Reserve bailed out the insurance giant AIG in a transaction that raised a whole lot of eyebrows for its not quite draconian, but certainly very stiff terms. That bailout is back in the news today. The guy who used to run AIG, Maurice Hank Greenberg, led a $40 billion class action suit against the government, saying the deal, the bailout, was unfair to AIG shareholders. This afternoon, a federal judge agreed that the terms were, quote, unduly harsh, but awarded Mr. Greenberg and his co-plaintiffs not a dime in damages. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson starts things off today.
Hank Greenberg may have been vindicated by this decision, but only partially.
So a Pyrrhic victory is you win the battle, but you still lose the war.
Ernie Patricus is a partner at White & Case, and he's previously worked at both AIG and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
Here he won the battle of was it an unconstitutional taking, but he lost the battle of does he get damages.
Greenberg had been seeking damages of up to $40 billion in compensation, but no damages means he gets nothing. Even though the judge found that the government overstepped when it took 80% of AIG's equity in exchange for the loan. John Coffey is a professor at Columbia Law School.
Remember, they were making an $85 billion loan, an extraordinary loan to one financial institution that had seemingly been run in a reckless fashion. And they were buying a pig in a poke. They didn't know just the full nature of the liabilities they were going to encounter when they took over the company. They wanted complete control.
And so the big question then is what this means for the next financial crisis, if there is one. Carl Tobias, a law professor at the University of Richmond, says the government could likely still make emergency loans, just not take equity, as they did with AIG.
It may be, if this stands, that Congress would have to revisit the authority of the federal government and try to expand it. So that it does have the flexibility to move in financial crises.
But first, he says this decision will almost certainly be appealed. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
The corporate story of the day is drugs. Pharmaceuticals, more properly, yes. Target is selling its pharmacies and clinics to the drugstore chain CVS Health for almost $2 billion. The deal is going to put CVS's brand on Target's pharmacies and clinics, and the companies are going to become long-term partners as well. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at why Target might be doing this.
Target has made a name for itself as a cheap, chic retailer, but it's not exactly a go-to spot for stuff like cholesterol meds. Adam Fine is a pharmaceutical management consultant. He says a lot of consumers hesitate to use a pharmacy at a mass merchant.
Because they don't think of the place where they get their DVDs, their TVs, and their bed sheets as the place they should also get their prescriptions.
Retail analyst Ken Perkins with Morningstar says only about 5% of Target's customers were actually using its pharmacy.
So Target was basically operating that business near break-even.
And pharmacy is not an easy space in which to make a profit. So says Brian Kilcourse. He's a retail technology expert with RSR Research.
You have to be able to drive volume through the pharmacy. To make that, let's call it the fixed cost part of your operation, make sense.
Kilcourse says those big fixed costs include highly trained pharmacists. Analysts seem to think bringing CVS on board makes a lot of sense for Target. It'll give customers access to more generic drugs, a program for managing prescriptions, and access to high-priced specialty drugs, like one for treating hepatitis C. Adam Fine, the pharmaceutical consultant, says those specialty drugs are a big deal in the pharmacy world these days.
CVS is the largest dispenser of these specialty drugs and has a number of programs and services that Target just can't offer.
Fine says if customers can get those drugs and services at a CVS within Target, they might stick around and stock up on diapers and clothing. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Wall Street today? Nuh-uh. Nope. No, ma'am. No siree, Bob. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Setting aside for the moment the issue of who inside the Vatican might leak a papal encyclical, it does appear that that's what's happened. The Italian magazine L'Espresso leaked a draft of a document today, 192 pages from the Pope, about climate change and its effect on the poor. The official release date is set to be Thursday. Vatican officials, mind you, are saying the official text is still under embargo. Marketplace's sustainability correspondent Scott Tong is on the line. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So with all the caveats that I mentioned in the introduction, what do we think the Pope is going to say on Thursday when this thing becomes official?
Well, we think the title is going to be best translated as Be Praised or Praised Be, referring to the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this encyclical we're expecting is going to say that the bulk of global warming comes from human activity. And that, of course, Kai, rhymes with the latest assessment by UN scientists. And one activity the document criticizes specifically is the intensive use of fossil fuels. It also endorses explicitly renewable energy. So this is a striking commentary that we're going to expect on the fuel of development and economic life, that is fossil fuels. As you said, this is a draft,
yep.
So the Vatican has asked for commentary to wait until Thursday, but the language certainly appears to be strong.
This is coming in a year that has been notable for climate change, right? All of it leading up to the big UN climate conference in Paris in December, right?
Well, you have a lot of disparate voices from different places speaking out this year on the use of climate change. Some are very surprising. Big European oil companies, including BP and Statoil and Total, have jointly called for a price, a penalty on carbon pollution. The Sovereign Wealth Fund of Norway, which is an oil power, which runs a $1.1 billion pension fund, it plans to sell off its coal investments. A lot of universities and the Rockefeller Foundation, as in Standard Oil, they plan to divest in fossil fuels too. And as you know, the U.S. and the Chinese governments have pledged climate-reducing plans. So all of this, as you say, feeds into the Paris UN Summit on Climate in December. And that's where the goal, as you know, is to combine the national pledges to keep the warming, the total warming, below 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit over pre-industrial levels. And so now we add to all of this broad climate conversation the moral voice of the Vatican this week.
Scott Tong on the Sustainability Desk in Washington for us. Thank you, Scott.
Okay, you're welcome.
Over the past couple of years, our education correspondent Amy Scott has been spending a lot of time in a school out in Cincinnati, Ohio, called Euler. Euler is trying to change its kids' lives by giving them the kind of support outside of class that kids who are better off often get at home. Things like healthcare and food and clothing, mentoring too. One part of that, especially nowadays, is technology. So here is Amy on Euler's digital divide.
Ray Nephew's seventh grade English class at Euler is about as high tech as it gets.
We have an Aquos smart board. We have a 32-inch Microsoft coffee table computer over there. We've got a cart of all different kinds of devices. We have an e-beam board.
This is not your typical classroom at Euler, or most places. It's one of six so-called demonstration classrooms in the district. Nephew models the latest teaching techniques and technology for other teachers. Each student also gets a laptop to use in class. Edward Denham leans over his, picking out a font for a digital slideshow he's putting together about a novel the class just read.
Like Times New Roman, Impacts, Georgia, and in those colors, I always choose neon green.
It's awesome.
Because it's awesome, he says. Ed is 12, and he loves computers. But when he goes home at the end of the day, he has to leave the laptop at school. And in his small beige house, a block from Euler, there's an Xbox, but no computer anymore. His mom, Diane Gribbins, had a laptop years ago when she had a job at a bank.
Like everything else, you know, they would wear out or tear up or whatever. Just don't have the cash to replace something like that when it goes, so... Especially with my family growing. I ended up having two more kids since then, and you can't afford things like that so easily.
The family of six can't afford high-speed internet either. Like many kids at Euler, Ed has a smartphone, but he says the connection is slow.
If I had internet at home, the first thing I'm asking my mom for is a laptop. You can use a laptop for so many things that I can't do on my phone.
like watch videos on YouTube, he says, and play better games.
A lot of research and things you could be looking up for school, too. You could do that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, schoolwork. It's not exactly easy to write a paper on a smartphone. Games aren't just play for Edward, though. He wants to be a game designer. Jim Steyer with the advocacy group Common Sense Media calls Ed's situation the homework gap.
We see this in low-income schools across the country where kids do not have access to the internet at home and literally can't do homework assignments that their technology-enabled classrooms would require.
Euler is working to close that gap. The school has teamed up with a local telecom company to bring several free Wi-Fi hotspots to the neighborhood. None of them reach Ed's house yet. And teacher Ray Nephew says even kids who now have access don't always have the right device.
It's forced us to do more in class than we really want to eventually have to do. You know, we try to move towards that flipped classroom model where the students can do a lot of the work outside of class via Blackboard or their Google account. But if you don't have a device at home and all you have is a smartphone, it is more difficult.
But technology has flipped the classroom in another way. Nephew is 52, and before this year had never even had a computer in his classroom.
My 15-year-old daughter would make fun of me that I couldn't send a text message or know how to work the new TV remote.
So he often asks his students for help. And that's been empowering for kids like Ed. At a recent tech fair, he got to dress up in professional clothes and school teachers on using their computers.
It felt like they were actually learning something about it, and I was actually teaching them about it. Like that I was being helpful to them about it.
His teacher, Nephew, still has plenty to teach Ed and his fellow digital natives. In his high-tech classroom, Nephew discovered a far more basic gap. Before the book they just finished reading, he says most of his seventh graders had never read a novel. In Cincinnati, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy made a documentary film about Euler while she was reporting her series for us. It is called Euler. You can watch parts of it tonight and tomorrow on the PBS NewsHour. We've also got a trailer for the film and all of the radio stories on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
There were pieces of steel that literally looked like Swiss cheese. The holes in it were bigger than your head.
American infrastructure, y'all, a whole series on it. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 107 points today, about 0.6%, finished at 17,791. The NASDAQ dropped 21 points, 0.4%, closed at 5,029. The S&P 500 gave up 9 points, 0.4%, to 2,084 at the bell there. So in honor of that infrastructure series here with a themed version of the numbers, the Fluor Corporation is one of this country's biggest builders, down 0.7% today. Texas-based Sterling Construction is big in highways and bridges, down 0.5%. Granite Construction, based out here in California, does tunnels as well, off 0.8%. To build 1 mile of a four-lane highway takes 85,000 tons of crushed stone, sand, and gravel. Aggregates, they are called. Vulcan Materials is the biggest aggregate operation in this country. Shares off 1.25%. Summit Materials does the stone, sand, and gravel thing as well. Ready-mix concrete, too, by the by, down 1.6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is listener-supported. So to keep our coverage relevant and compelling, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Your gift, in any amount, counts twice thanks to a dollar-for-dollar match from Newman's Own Foundation. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes in May. The Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates. It's one of eight regularly scheduled meetings for the year. And on June 16, 1933, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, was established when President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Banking Act of 1933 in the midst of the Great Depression. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You can count my $76 among the hundreds of millions that Jurassic World pulled in this weekend. Here in the States, the final tally was a record box office high of nearly $209 million in its opening weekend. International was a record, too, at more than $300 million, of which China was a big, big part. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill has that story.
The Chinese box office numbers roared in at more than $100 million.
I think it's not such a surprise.
Ann Kokas is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. She says China's going to keep setting records for American films.
At some point soon, we'll probably see the Chinese market becoming larger than the U.S. in every successive month.
There's a huge expansion in the number of theaters in China and a wealthier Chinese population. Michael Curtin is a professor of film and media studies at UC Santa Barbara.
So it's the sort of thing that Hollywood studios salivate about.
But Hollywood saliva alone does not land a movie on Chinese screens. The Chinese government allows only 34 movies a year to be imported. And Curtin says how exactly a film gets on that list is murky.
I don't think anybody in Hollywood can tell you. It has to do with relationships. It has to do with the nature of the film.
Curtin says these days studios work with Chinese censors in the earliest phases of planning a movie. Hollywood's also working on co-productions with Chinese studios to get around the quota. And broadly, it's all about the global audience. Janet Yang is a film producer. She says in the past, studios tried to appeal in a pretty rudimentary way.
Let's put a Chinese character or two into a Western, primarily Western production, or conversely, let's put a Western character or two into primarily Chinese production.
Now it's about finding truly organic international stories. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We're going to take some time this week to talk about infrastructure, how we get around and how we get our electricity and how we get our water and our goods and our services, all the stuff that an economy pretty much has to have. But it is stuff that in this country keeps on breaking. So some stories this week to explain why that stuff keeps on breaking and what's at stake if we don't fix it in a series called The Weak Link. Starting us off, arguably the biggest infrastructure project in the history of man, the American highway system, more than 200,000 miles of freeways and bridges and a whole lot of concrete. And that, in a way, is its weak link, how big it is, because now that infrastructure is breaking. It's falling down in some cases, costing us billions of dollars. And we pretty much have to keep on fixing it, even though a highway or a bridge might still be inadequate even after we've spent all the money. So, Marketplace's Adam Allington gets us going with the story of a New Jersey landmark.
Back in 1932, America was still suffering through the Great Depression, and our love affair with cars was just starting. And it was right here, about 5 miles from downtown Manhattan, just north of Newark, New Jersey, the Pulaski Skyway became our nation's first superhighway, a 3.5-mile raised roadway running over the top of the Meadowlands Industrial Area.
Even if you've never heard of the Pulaski, you've probably seen it. The Skyway looms in the background during the opening credits of The Sopranos. Back in the early 1930s, the only people who even knew how to build something this big were railroad engineers, which is exactly what the Skyway looks like, a 3.5-mile railroad bridge. Iron trusses, rivets, cantilevers. It's also 80 years old and falling apart.
There were pieces of steel that literally looked like Swiss cheese. The holes in it were bigger than your head.
Stephen Shapiro is director of communications for the New Jersey Department of Transportation. We're standing on the Skyway where workers are completing a 2-year, $1.2 billion rehabilitation of the Pulaski's concrete deck and steel cross braces.
The steel just flakes off. You can go to it and just peel a piece of steel off because it's rusted, deteriorated, and that's why it's being redone.
The Skyway is bound by Newark Airport on one end and the Holland Tunnel on the other. In between are continuous factories, warehouses, rail yards, as well as the ports of Newark and Elizabeth. It's some of the most built-up infrastructure anywhere. The Skyway carries some 70,000 cars a day. No trucks, though. Trucks were banned only 2 years after the Skyway opened because its narrow lanes and steep off-ramps were too dangerous, inadequate then and today. In infrastructure terms, the Pulaski is what's called functionally obsolete, meaning it doesn't meet modern design standards. And all the money being spent to fix it up won't change that, but Shapiro says it's not like they could just knock it down and start over.
We don't have the space to build out new highways like they can do in states like Texas or the Midwest, or where they can just build more lanes. We can't do that here. We have to work with what we've got.
In other words, having built it, we're locked in. It's a system of diminishing returns where we spend more money to fix old infrastructure that delivers less than optimal results and adds hours to commutes.
My name is Brian Higgins. I live in Hoboken, New Jersey, and my daily commute is from Hoboken to Newark.
Normally, Higgins would take the Pulaski Skyway, but the northbound lanes are closed for construction. Today, he and I are driving his alternate route home, which can easily double or triple his driving time.
Going home is where there's issues, especially as they continue to do construction on this route we're taking home now. So you run into other delays, and we're looking at what goes from roughly a 35-minute commute. It puts it at an hour and 15 minutes easily.
Higgins' commute underscores a key point about highways in America, that even in places as urbanized as northern Jersey with public transit options available, most people still drive to work.
In this region, only 4 out of 5 people actually drive to work. Most of the people that are commuting are driving automobiles. In New Jersey, it's over 90%.
Richard Barone is director of transportation for the Regional Plan Association, a policy group based in New York City. He says this situation is true among urban areas all across the country, let alone non-urban areas. Cars are still the way people get to work. But that can't go on forever. Barone says there just isn't enough money to maintain everything we've built, and priority should be given to infrastructure that gives us the most return on our investment. And that may mean fewer highways.
We're entering a phase where, you know, we have to make tough decisions, right? And the idea of removing a link from a network, especially on a highway network, is very unpopular.
Barone says the golden age of freeway building is over. They just cost too much, and as soon as they're built, they start breaking down, which is where we are today. Richard Puentes is director of the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program.
It's just reached the end of its useful life. A lot of it was just engineered to last for a certain number of decades to accommodate a certain number of drivers. We've blown way past a lot of those indicators in some areas.
Puentes says we'll never be able to build our way out of our infrastructure problem. And even if we did have enough money to fix everything, we'd still have gridlock, dangerous roads, and wasted economic opportunities. So how to change that? Well, for starters, we might think about the future of our highways as being driven by trucks.
We move an enormous amount of goods in this country, 77% of which cross state lines, which is really the definition of interstate commerce.
Puentes says the rapid growth of the Amazon-style e-commerce economy and the prospect of technology that includes, among other things, driverless trucks, mean freight may soon compete for a greater share of the roadway.
And so when we think about, you know, how this nation has grown in the past and the role of the interstates, maybe the new era is really going to be a lot around freight and good movement.
Many of those goods arrive here by boat and are then unloaded at New Jersey shipping terminals.
We see a 3-5% growth every year.
Jeff Bader is the president of the Association of Bi-State Motor Carriers. Much of that freight, he says, is being funneled onto roadways that weren't designed with trucks in mind.
I mean, we have trucks that are 53-foot, 54-foot long that cannot accommodate some of the roadways to make the turns.
And remember, the Pulaski can't carry any trucks at all. Even when freight can be moved by rail, Bader says that last mile will always involve trucks, and the money being spent on the Skyway, the biggest infrastructure project in the state of New Jersey, should have been put toward infrastructure that's more critical to the regional economy.
This putting billions of dollars into it now to make it more and more roadworthy for commuter vehicles. You look down underneath the Pulaski Skyway, the truck route 109, which is the sister bridge to it, is antiquated. It needs to be modernized and upgraded, too.
The Port of New York and New Jersey is spending $6 billion to improve its harbor and shipping terminals ahead of the completion of the Panama Canal expansion next spring. That's when so-called supercargo ships will start delivering even more containers, with more and more jobs relying on outdated infrastructure. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
We'd love for you to be part of this series with us and help us report on infrastructure where you live and work. We've teamed up with Waze, the navigation app, to do some stuff. Here's how it works. You download the app. You tap the report icon down in the lower right corner. You tell us about infrastructure issues where you live using the hashtag weeklink, and we will put all your reports on a map on marketplace.org. We can all check it out. Also, we're going to have those instructions on the website as well. This final note on the way out, Jeb Bush made it official today. He wants to be president. Big rally down in Miami, campaign posters, the whole smash. Also, it turns out, a little bit of digital fun. The New York Times noticed on now candidate Bush's website that the JavaScript of the announcement includes a synopsis of the movie Die Hard. Yes, that Die Hard. Why it includes a synopsis of the movie Die Hard, I have no idea. All right, one more time. We've got those Waze instructions for our infrastructure series on our website, marketplace.org. And don't miss Amy Scott, Euler, tonight on the NewsHour. Check your local listings, as they say. The Dow off 107 points to start the week, 0.6%. The NASDAQ down 21 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 gave up 9 points, also 0.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.